Thank you very much for leading us in the songs, all of you. It's just a delight to be able to sing together. Do you remember last year when we sang, we went out to the car park and we sang with just our voices, and it was beautiful just to hear that. But to be able to sing together here is a real delight. I'm so thankful for that. And I'm thankful for the work that Chris and the team put into it. So thank you very much. Well, tonight we're going to be going back into Hebrews. And for those who are younger or young at heart, we have some activity sheets for you. And I would invite my helper to come up now to help distribute these. So we have some different activity sheets and then some colored pencils you can use on those. And they'll be coming around. And just raise your hand or just kind of wink or something if you want one. And we'll bring that to you. Well, as we go back into Hebrews, we'll be back in chapter 11. We're looking at examples of faith, people who lived by faith. And they weren't written down here because they were exceptionally wonderful people. Some of them are rather embarrassing from what we know about them. And yet, it was by faith that they were able to please God and honor Him in spite of those issues that they had. So far, we've looked at Abel. His blood was crying out. He was murdered by his brother. Then we looked at Enoch. He walked, and then he was not. He was taken up. Then we saw last time, as Sandy opened up the scriptures for us, about Noah. And what a remarkable life that was to just glimpse that a little bit deeper. And then tonight we're going to go a little bit further into it, into this chapter, by looking at Abram, or Abraham as his name was called. And this is verses 9 or 8 through 19. So it's a larger section. There's a few things we're going to look at. And to help us in the process of looking at this, we're going to have some pictures and some words up here. And are we good to go on that? Perfect. There it is. Look at that. Okay. Sometimes we plan and then working beforehand, and then at the moment it just doesn't work. But thankfully our AV team's back there. Thank you. So it's the obedient faith of Abraham. So as we go into this text, I thought it'd be good if we read it first, and then we'll have that familiar text in front of us to be able to dig in a little bit deeper. So we're going to be reading Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 19. It says, "By faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed and set out for a place that he was going to receive as an inheritance. He went out, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he stayed as a foreigner in the land of promise, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, co-heirs of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself, when she was unable to have children, received power to conceive offspring, even though she was past the age, since she considered that the one who had promised was faithful. Therefore, from one man, in fact, from one as good as dead, came offspring as numerous as the stars of the sky and as innumerable as the grains of sand along the seashore. These all died in faith, although they had not received the things that were promised, but they saw them from a distance, greeted them, and confessed that they were foreigners and temporary residents on the earth. Now those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they were thinking about where they came from, they would not have had an opportunity to return. But they now desire a better place, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. He received the promises, and yet he was offering this one and only son, the one to whom it had been said, 'Your offspring will be traced through Isaac.' He considered God to be able even to raise someone from the dead. Therefore, he received him back, figuratively speaking." This is the Word of God, and we're going to look at it tonight. So, as it's oftentimes helpful for me, and I hope it's helpful for you, we have a big idea. And the big idea is not moving. Let's try this one here. There we go. The big idea for this passage is Hebrews 11, 8 through 19, highlights five features of obedient faith. Five features of obedient faith so that you will follow God fearlessly. Can you imagine not being afraid, not being worried about what God's asking you to do, but trusting Him so completely that you look fearless, because you are fearless. When we know our God like Abraham and Noah and Enoch knew God, a lot of the fear and scariness in life can be lifted away, and we can walk fearlessly after God. And so this text tonight will show us how we can see this happen. And so it's going to show us this by five features of obedient faith. And hopefully you hear that one word, obedience is key to fearlessness. So these five features of obedient faith look like this. And now they're a bit bigger than I normally give to you, so they'll be coming up. You'll see them again. If you can't get them all down now, that's okay. Maybe write the first one down if you're taking notes. So the five features of obedient faith so that you will follow God fearlessly. The first one is it obeys through uncertainty. Then it embraces temporality, or that which is temporary. I don't know about you, but there's something about having a really old cathedral just up the hill that makes you feel like we're going to be okay. The cathedral's been here for 1,000 years. But temporariness, it just makes me feel uneasy. It just can come and go so quickly. So we're going to learn how to embrace temporality. Thirdly, an obedient faith trusts during impossibility. When you feel like this is impossible, you don't lose heart or you don't fear. You trust God instead. Wait for Him to work it out. Fourthly, an obedient faith desires a heavenly locality. It's not just thinks it'd be nice, but yearns for it, longs for that heavenly place, that location that will be one day. And then lastly, the fifth feature of obedient faith is that it offers up expectantly. Offers up expectantly. So we're going to go into this first one, and it's going to take us a little bit to get to the meat, because as you understand the background, it makes what's going on so much more rich. So we're going to go back to this man, Abram. He lived in this part of the world. You can see up there some familiar places, like Egypt is down there, the Mediterranean Sea. You can just barely see Crete way off on the left-hand side. But there's a certain city that Abraham was born into, and he was born in the year 2091 B.C., about 2,000 years before Jesus was born. And he was born in this city right here, Ur of the Chaldeans. And in Ur, he lived there, and it was a place that wasn't just a city. It was the most important city of its day. It was possibly the largest city of the day. People estimate between 65,000 and some people say as many as 350,000 people live there. That green section that you see shows the influence of Ur. Ur was the capital of the Sumerian empire. And they had an influence that spread out across the river. And then it even went a little bit further. And it went beyond, down to the Persian Gulf. And this is the area that they influenced. A smaller kingdom, but for that period of time, it was a significant thing to have a kingdom at all. So this kingdom was flourishing there along the Euphrates River. It was governed by a man with a really cool name. You want to hear his name? His name was Ur-Nammu. Maybe your name is something simple like Sandeep or Greg, but Ur-Nammu is not a common name. I don't think you're going to meet many, but that was a good name, and you can see Ur and the city Ur. There's probably a connection there. Well, he was a self-made king. We don't know all the history, but somehow he got into power. But he did a really good job of ruling, and he was a builder. This is what some people think Ur looks like back in that time. It was a rather beautiful city right along the river. Lots of people were gathered around, and that central square there is a temple square. We're going to be looking at that in a moment, but he helped build the city up. One of the things that he did was he helped develop a code of laws. In fact, one of the oldest known code of laws in human history. And it was called the Codex Ur-Nammu. He named it after himself because it was so good. In this codex, he made it sure that people wouldn't have oppressive taxes on them. I wish many governments would take a page from that. The codex. He standardized weights and measurements so people wouldn't be tricked and deceived. He had protection in there for the poor. This predates a common code that people know about called the Code of Hammurabi. And many people know the Code of Hammurabi by a famous saying, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Ironically, the Bible has that same thing in it because that was first the Bible's idea, then it was written down by people later. But this codex Ur-Nammu came about 300 years before the Code of Hammurabi. And you can go to the British Museum and see part of the Code of Hammurabi, though it is located primarily in Paris. Well, in this beautiful kingdom, good old Ur, he developed industry. And so there were factories there. There were metalworking plants. They also had a development for the arts. And they had lots of arts. You can find artifacts today. They actually were pretty good artists. And one thing they loved to do in their art is show how great they were and superior they were. So if you went and visited Ur, you would see walls painted with the superior Chaldeans, usually standing over or running over the people who they were trying to conquer. And so as a way of saying, look, we're glad you could be here, but don't make us angry. We will run you down. So at the bottom there, you can see that they have chariots, and you can't quite see through the text there, but there are people underneath the horses that they're jumping over. They're playing games together. I'm sure the people weren't hurt at all as the horses leapt over them and the chariots were dragged behind. But this is what they were like. They're artists. But one thing that I just saw in the British Museum this weekend was this classic piece of art called Ram Caught in a Thicket. One thing I love is when the title seems to match the object, Ram Caught in a Thicket. Many people thought when this was first discovered, it was depicting the story of Abraham and his son Isaac, and the ram was caught there. But actually, it has something to do with that story. It is just a ram, a goat, that was eating brush. But they designed it with beautiful things. It has incredible craftsmanship. It was made of wood and gold and silver, lapis lazuli, seashells were on it. It's one of two. The other is in the University of Pennsylvania in the United States. But these two statues were found in a mass grave. They just buried this artwork with the people as a way to honor the dead. So this animal, this goat, is foraging for food, but it kind of gives you an idea of what time, life would have been like at this time. Well, they also had things like textile industry. So they wove wool together and sold their wool. It was popular. They made carpets. I don't think there were magic carpets that flew, but they were highly sought after. They had a very cultured and sophisticated city. It was a powerful city as well. In fact, one of the things about this empire, the Sumerian Empire, was that's the oldest known writing that we have in human history. And it dates back to around 3000 BC. And this is what it looked like. This is it. Cuneiform. Now we learn our ABCs here. They learn their triangle right, triangle up, and triangle down as a way to make words. It was a ingenious way of writing, and you can see if you want the code, there it is at the bottom, and you can match up the symbol with the letter and figure out what they're saying. I'm sure it was, honey, could you please pick up some eggs at the market? It took her half hour to get it, but it was important. But what's great about the Sumerians is they had entire libraries of clay tablets that were about the size of your Bible, and they just gouge these things with these little styluses like this. And it was a triangle shape, and they would use a piece of clay when it was soft, like we do with Play-Doh or clay today, and you make symbols on it, graffiti. And then if you want a closer look at it, this is the stylus, and you can just see it makes those triangle shapes, and depending on the way you turn it, how many you have together, that was the alphabet. It was designed by these people where Abraham lived. So as we look about these people, they learned about diplomacy, business. Boys and girls would go to school. Primarily, the emphasis would be for boys. They learned how to read. They learned how to write. They learned how to write cuneiform. They learned their maths, division. They learned multiplication. And they learned about religion. As they grew beyond just simple math, they developed architecture. In fact, these old buildings were two stories high a very difficult task considering the elements that they worked with. But they were mainly a middle-class society of people who owned their homes. They had indoor plumbing, if you can imagine that. And one thing that's interesting is about 50 years after Abraham leaves Ur, it was destroyed completely by raiding bands of warriors. Well, the center of society of the Sumerians, this is helpful to understand Abram's situation and why he's marked out as a man of faith. But at the center of their society was this. It was the god of the moon. His name was Sin, or Nana, and it kind of sounds like na-na-na, 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 goodbye. I don't know if you heard that song, but it's Nana, not Nana, but Nana and Sin were the same name for this god. He was represented by a crescent, and so you see this crescent there, I circled it, or that stone there. Do you see the crescents? Okay, I'm going to highlight them for you. It's kind of those find the hidden picture. Here we go. So that's the code there. Anytime you see these symbols, the crescent moon, it was a way to honor the god. What's interesting is the symbol was adopted by Islam later, and it shows that the Islamic faith actually has roots in paganism that goes back to Ur. So this is where we see the evidence of this worship, but I showed you that picture at the beginning of Ur, and there's a big temple complex there, and in the middle of it is this ziggurat, this pyramid. It was a square pyramid. It was a place where they worshipped their god. It was probably about 10 stories tall, so about 30 meters high. And the top room was a special room. It was covered in silver, and it was a place that was dedicated specifically to worshiping this moon god, Nana. And this was the capital of the world for the worship of the moon god. And so people would come from all over to pay homage to the moon god. And so this is the culture in which Abraham lived. We are gathering from Abraham as he progressed in life that he would have come from a fairly wealthy family, but he would have been going to the temple, worshiping the moon god like everybody else. His family would have been entrenched in this religion. In fact, his father's name was Terah, or Terah, which means the moon. He was named in honor of the moon god. This is Abraham's legacy. And this worship of this moon god existed for 1,400 years before Abraham was born. So Abraham of Ur was wealthy. He probably had fine art collections and treasures. He lived in a fairly nice home. He was an upperclassman. He was a free man. He would have been literate and fluent in Sumerian, in Akkadian, and probably Egyptian. In Joshua 24, verse 2, it says that he served other gods, like the rest, when he lived in Ur. So to leave all this would have taken Abram into an area that he had no knowledge of. Now, he might have done some traveling, but he was going to leave it all behind. And he didn't just leave as a young man trying to find out his life. He was 75 years old. 75 years old, and he's going to go to a new place. Now, initially, in Genesis 11, his father moves the family up north. And actually, I just realized here I have a couple pictures of this temple I wanted to show you. This is what it was like when they first discovered it in the 1920s by a British explorer. And if you were going to go to Ur, you'd have to get on an airplane. Well, first of all, you have to get on a train, go 2 hours south to London. Then it's going to be an 8-hour flight to Baghdad. And then it's going to be a 3-hour drive south to Ur. That's how long it would take you to get to Ur from London. And then you could go and visit this ziggurat. And it was rebuilt by Saddam Hussein, that great dictator. He built it probably to honor himself. He actually hid inside of it during the Gulf War, thinking no one would try to shoot at him inside this impressive an important landmark, but he built it up. He built those steps there. And an artist's rendition of it was this beautiful temple. And at the very top would have been that place where they worshipped their god, Nana. Well, this is where Abraham was living. And so he's going to go on a long trip up to Haran. And Haran is way up there. And so it's going to take about 1,000 136 kilometers or 705 miles just to get there. So if you're in England, the UK, you're going to start down in Brighton, and you're going to go all the way to the northern tip of Scotland. And I looked it up. It's called, sorry if I pronounce it wrong, but Thurso is about the same distance as what Abraham did. It would take about 14 and a half hours to drive this distance, and he's going all the way up into modern Turkey. That's a long way. And so his family just moved up there. When they got there, it turns out that Haran is the second most important city for this moon god. And so they have here a shrine to the moon god, not up on a ziggurat, but still an important place. And we found some, well, they reconstructed some of the homes. They look very interesting. I don't know if you like to live in the beehives, but this is what they look like. And they have a whole bunch of these in Haran. And inside, they're rather pleasant. You can see what it looked like. You can have a comfortable living there. It helps with the heat to go up. It traps in the coolness of the summer. So this is what it would have been like. And they moved to there. And so that's where they were for a while. 700 miles north of everything that they knew. And so they let go of it. But we have to remember that even there in Haran, Abraham is not following God yet. He doesn't know about God yet. He didn't grow up in a Christian home. He would have joined with all the others down at the shrine to worship the moon god. He didn't know about Abel. He didn't know about Enoch. He didn't know about Noah. And it was into this heathenism that God reached down and picked this one man. And do you think God picked him because he was handsome? No. Maybe God picked him because he was really clever. No, he wasn't clever. May have been, but it's not why God chose him. We don't think God chose him because he was a good artist. We don't know. God chose him because God is merciful. It's in God's nature to be kind and compassionate. He picked out this one man, a heathen, a moon worshiper, most likely. And he picked him out and said, "You're going to be my special representative on earth." Now, when God calls, he doesn't negotiate. He doesn't say, "Okay, I'll give you a little bit of this if you'll come and join with me." He says, "Follow me." And so this is when we see that Abraham is going to obey through uncertainty. It already was unnerving to go so far away from his home. But now at 75, God says to him, we read about it in Genesis 12, "I want you to go to a land that you do not know." Now, he didn't have a sat-nav to guide him. The sat-nav wasn't going to say, "Turn left in 100 meters. The sat-nav wasn't there. And so he just had to go out. And with him came his wife and came his nephew, Lot, and they went out. He left his land, which means he left all the national gods. He left his relatives. He left the clan gods and the clan practices. And he left his father's house, the family rituals, the ancestral gods that they had. He was leaving all that behind for uncertainty. When we moved over here, we made lots of plans about how we're going to ship our things, where we're going to land, how much the plane tickets are going to be. But can you imagine just setting out and going across Europe and thinking you're going to strike a place and dwell there, live there? What's also astonishing is Abraham has no background with this God to trust him. But he still went. He went because God had spoken to him and he's trusting the word of God. And that is what we do today, isn't it? We trust God's word to guide us. His written word that he's given to us. So Abraham serves as an illustration of what it looks like to live by faith. Now, God calls him and God will not fail. God said he's going to make Abraham into a great nation. In fact, he gave him the name Abraham later, which means the father of multitudes of nations. And this was a unique thing in this world. And all the gods, they sometimes were thought to speak to people, but they never pulled someone completely out of the world and said, "Now I'm going to make a new nation out of you that will bless the world." That was unheard of. Think about for Abraham to hear that and wonder, what is going on? Why would God choose me? Well, Abraham's obedience was based on a promise. Now, we have far more information than Abraham had. And yet, isn't it interesting how we have trouble obeying God? It's not for lack of knowledge or lack of understanding of God's will. It's because there's still doubts in our heart, isn't it? We have so much more clarity about the inheritance Abraham was promised. We have so much more information about how to go about our life, and yet we still struggle to obey. And that's why Abraham should astound us. How little he had and how much he trusted. But the same faith that sustained Abraham can sustain us. His faith was no different. And it is a faith that pleases God. Well, here's Abraham's secret. You want to know how he did it? How you can live fearlessly? He believed that God existed and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. And so therefore, he followed God. The focus is on God, not on what we don't know. Let that take care of itself. Our job is to trust the God that we know. Obey even through uncertainty. Well, there's a second aspect here. And the second aspect is that an act of faith will embrace temporality. So if you look at verses 9 and 10, Abraham stayed as a foreigner in the land of promise, living in the tents as did Isaac and Jacob, co-heirs of the same promise. Isaac was his son, Jacob was his grandson, and they lived in what? Tents. I wouldn't have any of you gone tent camping before. We used to love going tent camping, but then we also loved to go and get a shower and cleaned up and then go back to our comfy beds. But he left his comfy bed. He left his mansion and his wealth, and he went out to go tent camping for the rest of his life. I wonder, wives, how many of you would be excited if your husband said, guess what we're going to do for the rest of our lives? Make sure you have an air mattress at least, right? Something comfortable. But he left, and this is an incredibly important thing to understand. He went all the way up to Haran, and now he's going to go down, down, down into Canaan land. Not sure where to stop. He's just assuming his sat-nav from God will say, stop here and wait for the further instructions. Eventually, when you're in a strange land, it becomes more familiar. We've learned how to get away around Lincoln after a year and a half. We kind of understand the layout of the streets. But when you first get here, we were confused and not sure where to turn. We turned one way thinking that's where we're supposed to go, and then I don't even know where I am. Thankfully, I had the sat-nav. But he went and lived there, and eventually it's become familiar, and it would turn into his son's land and then his grandson's land, but never really their land. And so he's embracing this temporality. You can see down there in the valley, he has his tent set up, and he's looking at the land and realizing this is just a temporary stop. Where we're going to go next, I don't know. But what he passed on to Isaac and to Jacob was the promise that God had given him. He made sure to tell them this tent that they lived in was just a reminder that this world is not their home. And so they learned as a family to embrace temporality, to live in a way that would keep them from settling down and loving the land too much. So this meant he deliberately chose the identity of a foreigner. Now, some of us, I shouldn't speak too broadly here, but some of us can't hide our foreignness. I say hello, and everyone knows immediately, oh, you're not from around here, are you? Oh, really? Yeah, it's true. My ancestors may have been, I don't know, but no, I'm not from around here. You're immediately given away, and as much as I try to blend in, to wear the clothes of the local natives and to adopt their customs, I'm always outed as a foreigner. And that's a good thing. It reminds me that this world is not my home. Don't look to this world to get my satisfaction from. So what was he looking to? How did he keep his focus? Well, verse 10, he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, not like his tent, a foundations whose architect and builder is God. By the time Abraham moves into Canaan, he probably got word about the destruction of Ur. Would have happened sometime around his time there. And he would have realized that city, the great city of Ur and all its magnificence, isn't permanent. What is permanent? There's a city that he was looking forward to, and its designer, its builder was God, which would make it completely different than anyone else's. It'd make it completely different than portable tents. So he made it a habit to look forward and to not look down or to not look around. Now this is thinking about unsettledness. It would be like if you heard tomorrow that London has been destroyed. Can you imagine? You've been to London, you know how old that city is, but to think it was completely destroyed and razed to the ground, it would shake us, wouldn't it? It helped Abraham trust God even more. This is particularly important to the believers that would be reading this letter. They were at a time when there was immense persecution. And things were coming after them, and they were being having their goods being stolen from them, confiscated. People were being thrown in prison. They were being publicly ridiculed. They would love to know that this was the father of their faith, Abraham. He endured the same thing. Reminds me of a song that you probably would recognize. While we walk the pilgrim pathway, clouds overspread the sky. But when traveling days are over, not a shadow, not a sigh. When we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be. When we all see Jesus, we'll sing and shout the victory, and we'll be home. Well, there is another aspect of this obedient faith, another feature, and that is that it trusts during impossibility. Here we have a picture of an old Abraham. He was 99 years old, and Sarah was equally as old, about 10 years younger, and they have a baby. He had spent 25 years of his life having left Haran, and God had told him, through you will come children, so many as the sand of the seashore. And 25 years of infertility. Now, for those who have struggled with infertility, you know what a difficulty that is. Bitterness is hard to keep away. Just the sound of children laughing and running around can be so painful for these couples. Or even just think about, have you waited 25 years for anything? Something that you were longing for, and year after year it didn't come. Well, 25 years after the promise for innumerable descendants, no one was born yet. It would feel like a death, a cruel joke. Now, because of Abraham and Sarah's age, they were considered, as the text says, as good as dead, incapable of producing new children. Now think about this. Abraham's name means father of nations. And so the great hospitality that they're famous for, as a visitor comes in and stays with Abraham and learns his name. Oh, Abraham, oh, how many grandchildren and great-grandchildren do you have, father of nations? And he would say, actually, I have none. Oh, that's unfortunate. He would live with that. As people would look at he and Sarah, there's no children of their own. And then it focuses on Sarah. It says here in verse 11, by faith, even Sarah herself, when she was unable to have children, received power to conceive offspring, even when she was past the age, because she trusted God. Now, when we go back to the text, we know that Sarah actually laughed when she heard she was going to have a child in the next year. But something changed, and she didn't remain that way, and neither did Abraham. They trusted God. And so what happens is, through that faith, God blessed them. The end result was one child, a down payment for all the coming multitudes that would be behind him. And later these things happened. And it says in Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6, that Abraham believed the Lord, and you know this part, it was counted to him as righteousness. Abraham, the father of faith. So Abraham and Sarah remind us that God can do the impossible. So when you feel like this is impossible to solve a situation, take a cue from Abraham and Sarah and trust God. Trust God. Nothing is impossible for God. He does fulfill His promises. It'll come in His time, oftentimes when you don't expect it. But our part is simply to believe God, to get to know Him. Let Him worry about the details. Verse 12 encourages us to keep on waiting, to keep on doing what we're supposed to do. Act in faith in the areas that you can see, and let God take care of the impossibility. Well, there was another part here of this features of faith, and it's the fourth one. That a fearless faith will desire a heavenly locality. Now, this is a strange switch. We're talking about Abraham and Sarah, and then verses 12 through 16, or 13 through 16, it kind of removes us to a different location, a different people. That's because this is the center of chapter 11. It's saying right down here at the core of this passage, this is what's going on. All these people, not just Abel and Enoch and Noah, but all the people that he's going to talk about afterwards, they died in faith. That seems like a raw deal. They trusted God and they didn't get what they were hoping for. They did not receive, although they did not receive what the things that they were promised. But they saw them from a distance, greeted them, and confessed that they were foreigners and temporary residents on the earth. They saw the promise of what God had for them, and they said, I'm going to reject anything here of permanence to have that, because that can never be taken away. It's a locality beyond the corruption and the diseases and the sins of this world. It's a place that is safe. Safe from the sins of others and safe from my own corruption that I bring to it. And so these people were looking out. They were the ones that have walked trusting God. And they faced uncertainty. They faced temporality. They faced impossibility. And they died in faith. But they didn't die in futility. This isn't made for us to have pity on them. They died happy. Because they could see, as soon as I go through the doors of death, I will be home. And that's how we need to look at death. It is actually a servant that brings us into the presence of God. They look through death to the promise. So living by faith doesn't mean we avoid death. It means that we trust even death will bring us the reward that we are eagerly awaiting. So their desire was fixed on that heaven, that space, that locality that all of those who trust Jesus will be able to go to one day. Christian, are you trusting in that as your home? Or are you starting to put roots down here a little too much? I remember when as a young child, I grew up in the state of Colorado, known for its mountains and skiing and outdoors activities. Beautiful place. It was a wonderful place to grow up. And then I left Colorado to go to university in Los Angeles. And then after Los Angeles, we moved to South America. And then eventually we made our way back to Colorado. And there was something that had changed. This place that we loved so much wasn't the same as it used to be. People had developed different politics and different ways of thinking and using the spaces that just felt out of place. We loved the mountains, but it just wasn't our home. And that was so helpful for us to remember, don't put our heart into a physical location here. Fix your hope on heaven. In fact, it says they fixed it so much on heaven that it was impossible for them to go back to where they had come from. There was nothing for them. Now, as good as things may get here, they cannot compare to what's coming. If you think this is your best life now, when you get to heaven, you'll look back at this and it'll look like suffering. If you are headed to heaven, you will look back and laugh at all the joy you took in this place because what's coming is so much better. You do not have your best life here, friends. It's what's coming. If you think this is your best life, and it actually is, it may be that you're not headed to heaven. I encourage you, examine your heart. Are you trusting in God? Is He your treasure? Or is it the things of this world? This is meant to jar us, to make us really evaluate our heart. What do I long for? Am I helping my children to fix their hope on heaven? Or am I helping them to settle down here? Husbands, are you encouraging your wife to look to the things that are permanent, to that locality that is pure and holy? What's amazing about this text is it says that the kind of people who do this are the ones that God is not ashamed to be called their God. I mean, can you imagine that God would look down at you and say, I am proud to be her God. I am so delighted that He calls me His God. I'm glad when He publicly names me because I have no shame because He's living His life by faith. Oh, that is the city that God has prepared for us. Our citizenship is there. It's what we're longing for. There's one more aspect to this obedient faith, another feature, and that is that an obedient faith will offer up expectantly. And we've seen this. Abraham was asked by God to offer his only son, Isaac. Not just offer him to go to live in a temple, but to take his son's life. And so Abraham was living down here around this area of Hebron. And he was going to go not too far away up to what is now Jerusalem, where Mount Moriah sits under the temple. And he's going to go there, and he was told to sacrifice Isaac. What's amazing about this is that Abraham doesn't complain. He doesn't try to barter. He doesn't try to argue his way out. We know it was a test. The Bible tells us that, but Abraham wasn't given that information. 1 Peter 1:7 explains that various trials have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. What's the purpose of a test? It's to reveal the genuineness of our faith. Not because God doesn't know, but helps us to see the nature of our faith. So here comes Abraham, over 100 years old. He's with his son, his only true son, 13 years old, and now he's asked to kill that one and only son. And this is a son that God guaranteed. All your descendants, your name will become a reality through this one son. And Abraham obeys right away without delay. Immediately, the next morning, he gets up and goes. And he goes forward expectantly. This is an astonishing thing. But his faith wasn't irrational. He was like that because he knew his God. He knew that if he offered up Isaac, and he did take Isaac's life, God is the kind of God that can raise Isaac from the dead. He trusted God so explicitly that he had no problems in going. Oftentimes the story is portrayed as Abraham stayed up all night weeping at the thought of losing his son. It's portrayed as Abraham and Sarah have a long hug because they know that Isaac may not be coming back. But do you remember what Abraham said to his servants as they got to the mountain? He said to them in Genesis 22:5, "Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there to worship. Then we'll come back to you." We, both of us, will come back. Abraham was certain God would work this out. Now, very few of us are going to be asked to do this extreme measure of a test. But we all have precious things, don't we? Things that if God asked us to give up would be hard to do. God is saying, trust me. Give up whatever he asks, expecting that he will either give you something better or in the end of the day save you from giving that up. This wasn't a blind faith. Abraham reasoned it through and he knew that God is trustworthy. So Christian, one of the things we can do is flex your faith muscles in small areas, those little areas. Do it consistently, not in blind faith, but trusting God. Flex those muscles and then find out God is faithful. Every day do something. Trust the Lord in some area, because then when you get into a bigger area, it won't be quite as big because your muscles will be stronger. You will be able to endure longer. And then you'll be taken to a much more difficult test that 10 years before would destroy you, but you find yourself still walking because you've been trusting the Lord in those little areas. Every day rehearse the truth that God exists and what that means. Remind yourself of what kind of a God is it. Remind yourself of his promises to you. Remember that he is a God who rewards those who seek him. So keep seeking after God, trusting him for that reward. Keep seeking after his kingdom first, and all the rest will be given unto you. Remember, Abraham didn't get to this point overnight. It was a long journey from Ur up to Haran. A long journey from Haran all the way down to Canaan. But when he got there, he lived by faith. In closing, Arthur Pink said, "The Lord has an absolute claim upon us, upon all that we have. As our maker and sovereign, he has a right to demand from us anything he pleases. And whatsoever he requires, we must yield. All that we have comes from him. We must be held for him at his disposal. The bounty of God should encourage us to surrender freely. Whenever he calls, whatever he calls for, no one will be at a loss by giving it up to God." So, what are these five features of faith? It's an obedient faith that obeys through uncertainty. It embraces temporality. It trusts during impossibility. It desires a heavenly locality, and it offers up expectantly. All this is the obedient faith of Abraham, and one that we can have as well. We're going to finish with a song, and I'm going to invite the worship team to come back. As we sing this song, ask that God would help you to follow Him fearlessly, because we can all live that way. Would you stand with us as we sing this song together?